Hello, this is Mike Lane, and welcome to the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. I am very happy to have a guest with me tonight. It is Miss Jennifer DeRoss, who is the author of Forgotten All-Star, a biography of Gardner Fox. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
First of all, I want to thank you a lot for coming on. I've been super excited about this book ever since I first heard it was coming. And, of course, I picked it up this week, which I think was the first week of release. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm already on, I'm about to start the seventh chapter, the Wonder Woman chapter. Oh, wow. So yeah, I've been enjoying it.
Good.
Yeah. So I want to start out before we talk about the book, I wanted to talk about you a little bit.
Yeah.
Can you tell me your comics origin story, how you got into comic books?
Well, my grandma was actually the one who got me into comic books. She has a firm belief that all kids love comics, and she herself was a big comic fan, especially newspaper strips. She used to even, like, cut out the strip, because I grew up out in the boonies, and so I didn't have, you know, any way to get newspapers to my house or anything like that. And so my grandma would cut out the strips that she thought I would like and mail them to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she would do the same thing with cartoons. I got my Ninja Turtles because she would record it on VHS and send it to me. And so when the generator would run, I'd get to watch my Ninja Turtles. And so she was the one who got me into comics. But really, just about everybody in my life was into comics in some way. They just were into different parts of comics. Like, my biological father was really into, like, Adam's Family and those sort of strips. And then my stepdad was really into, like, Mad and Spy versus Spy, especially.
Wow. First, you had an awesome grandma. That sounds wonderful. It sounds like there was a big newspaper presence and comic strip newspaper presence as opposed to comic books. Did you get into newspaper strips before you started reading actual comic books, or...?
I would say it happened about the same time. It started out probably with newspapers. My grandma has a huge Garfield collection. Like, she was one of those people with, like, the Garfield phone and the Garfield stuffies and, like all the Garfield. But she also really liked Silver Age DC specifically. And so I remember a lot of Silver Age DC in my youth. She especially wanted me to be into Wonder Woman, which I was really resistant to, because I was like, that's just because it's a girl. I don't want to feel like I have to like this character because I'm a girl. I felt targeted as a female, and I didn't like that.
Wow. So who were you into as a kid, superhero-wise?
Batman was one of my early favorites, but honestly, my first love was Aquaman. That terrible 60s cartoon that everybody makes fun of, I absolutely loved. And I still, like, I can look back and, like, the cinematography that they put into that, the backgrounds, the water effects, like, it's more quality than people are giving it credit for.
I hope Rob Kelly listens to this, because he would be ecstatic to hear you gushing about the Aquaman. So, well, I understand your reluctance on Wonder Woman, but did you come around?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It took me a few years. I would say that I was suffering from a little bit of internalized misogyny there, but we worked through it.
Well, so would it be fair to say that you kind of, was it around so early that you couldn't even necessarily remember, like, the very beginnings? It was just always been there?
Absolutely. That and Star Wars are the two things that, like, that I have no early memories. It was just there.
Well, when did you start to sort of take it a little more seriously? And I guess what I mean is, when did you go from just being a reader to kind of getting into the history of it and the creators who made them?
Going back to Spy versus Spy, when it was explained to me that it was political satire, that, like, it's about the meaninglessness and that, like, the two sides are so equal. Like, and how do you separate the, like, the entire concept that the comic could be taking on something like that? It really opened my eyes to what a comic could be and made me look at them differently. And once that happened, I started paying a lot more attention to comics. And that happened when I was, like, a teenager. And then fandom kind of took over. We were talking briefly before about Buffy. So a lot of things kind of culminesced for me. And by the time that I got back into school, I found out that there was a comic studies minor at the U of O. And it was one of those, I had to do that. Like, as soon as I found out that was something I could do, that was something I wanted to do.
Now, did you have necessarily the intent to be someone who was going to become a writer, you know, comic scholar? Or was it more that you just sort of casually wanted to learn, or was it just a mix of both?
Oh, that's a good question. Because I've been trying to reconcile with that a little. I had never considered myself a writer, or I wouldn't say that I had aspirations to be an author, but I did always enjoy writing. And my mom can point to very specific moments where she's like, no, this makes sense for you. And so I think I lacked a little self-awareness on that. But I definitely enjoyed writing about comics. And that was something that I talked about when I applied to the master's program. One of the reasons that I wanted comics, specifically the modern American superhero, to be my main focus in the master's program was because I felt like that's when I did my best writing. That's when I felt the most passion. And so it makes sense in that way for that just to continue.
Well, let me ask you the big question in regard to your book. Why Gardner Fox?
Well, it started out just being at the right place. And at the right time in my life. I had just, the summer before I went into the grad program, I was doing archival work at the writing center I was working at. And then I found out that one of the classes that I could take in my first term was on 19th century archives. And so it was one of those, I knew that the Gardner Fox collection was there at U of O. And so I talked to the teacher and I said, can I do work on the Gardner Fox collection for your class? And she agreed. I pretty fast figured out that there's just not a lot of work out there on him. And the more time I spent and the more I realized just how central he is to everything in comic book history, especially DC history. And the fact that there's just nobody talking about it, that he's not well known the way that other writers of the era are, I became emotionally attached.
You know, it is shocking when you think of all the books that have come out over the last 10 years from like Bill Shelley and Tomorrow's, that there has not been a Gardner Fox biography already. I mean, because if not to say that all, I mean, I love all those books and I get thrilled every time one is published, but influence wise, yeah, Gardner Fox. I mean, Justice Society of America, Justice League of America, half the members of the Justice Society. I mean, it's stunning, really. And not to mention, I mean, that's just the characters he created, but his output. I mean, how many, I don't know the exact number, but how many comics did he write in his lifetime?
Well, according to his records in, I had to cite this specifically.
Yeah, I read it in your book, I think, and I can't remember what it was, but it was a stunning number.
Yeah, by his own records, as of 1980, and he wrote after this, he had already written 4,213 comic book stories.
Good God. That's amazing.
Second most prolific comic book writer ever.
I should know this, but who is the most?
Kanger. Robert.
Oh, okay. I should. Okay. Perfect sense. Yeah. I'm Sergeant Rock alone is how many hundreds and hundreds of issues. Now, before we kind of get further into the book, I want to ask you, Gardner Foxwise, of his creations, is there a particular favorite among them or favorites?
I have a lot of favorites. I love early Dr. Fate, and I worry just a little too much that that's obvious in the book. Like, I really, and I love Hot Girl. She's one of my favorites. I think that she shows such gumption. She's a hero before she's a hero. You know, like, we see how active she is. Like, it blows my mind the issue where she's using Laureate to swing over the building and get into the window of the bomb maker. And she's doing all of that just as a citizen. Like, and she learned that from, like, going to a dude ranch. And, like, she, like, you don't get those kinds of sidekicks, especially not female sidekicks, because that's essentially what it was. And then she becomes this huge hero. But I love that she showed such gumption and determination, and she was always, like, you know, they had this playful relationship where she was always trying to, like, show the hawk up, you know? Like, I like that a lot.
You know, I understand that, because actually probably my favorite is the original Sandman.
Yeah.
And with Deanne, they had a very similar relationship as well. Unfortunately, she eventually got pushed to the side for Sandy when he got that kind of reboot in the 40s. But, and a part of my perceptions are colored by the 90s Sandman Mystery Theater series, where I always felt like she was more of the main character than he was. But nevertheless, I think a lot of the dynamics, they were pulling from the original Gardner Fox stories. And I love their relationship. I think it's very similar in a lot of what you said about Hawkman and Hawkgirl.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And you can see some of that with Isna Kramer and Dr. Fate as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. It didn't click at the time, but now that you pointed it out, I could see that Dr. Fate did get a little bit more attention in the JSA chapter than some of the other characters, getting into Wotan and her and Inza and their relationship. But it was great. And it didn't stand out at the time at all. But it's just now that you mention it, I can kind of go back and see that in my head. It was a great chapter, though.
Thank you.
One of the things that jumped out at me, too, it probably of all the things, and again, I've finished six chapters, so I've got a lot to go. But the thing that jumped out at me most about Gardner Fox was his work ethic. And it's somewhat obvious because he was so prolific, because we haven't even mentioned the novels he wrote as well, which is a huge number. We've just talked about the comic books. But I don't just mean his sheer output, but I mean his day-to-day work ethic of the blocks of time he set aside where he would sit there. And you mentioned the hours that every day consistently he was devoted to writing. And that blew my mind just because, I mean, I'm not a writer. I can't speak for writers, but I get the sense it's a struggle a lot, that writer's block is a real thing. It's a thing they have to fight. And he seemed to be able to just sit down and pump out these original stories day in and day out for, what, 40 plus years? It's stunning to me.
Yeah, I mean, even on vacation, that's one of the things that I talk about. Like, he would take his legal pads down to the beach and be writing even then. Like, he really had a strong work ethic, but I think that for him, it was something he loved. He really enjoyed writing those stories. And I think in a lot of ways that sense of adventure that he sought in his life, he got through writing the stories. And so I don't think he saw it as detrimental at all. Even when he retired, he kept writing because it was something he felt passionate about doing.
And I guess since he did change careers from the law to just completely writing, he must have had a fondness for it. Yeah. I don't want to give away too many details of the book and spoil anything, because obviously we want everyone to buy one. But one thing that stands out about his work ethic is that time I just read the story of the relative who had hitchhiked to visit him and had gone through these incredible lengths to visit, you know, Gardner and his wife. And when he shows up, Fox just blows up at him out of anger because he doesn't want, it's his work time. That's when he writes. And the poor guy wasn't let in and had to hitchhike back home again or wherever he was staying. and never got to visit. And I felt really bad for the guy, but I was thinking, damn, Gardner really takes his work seriously.
Well, I mean, the way I thought about that is, how would you feel if you're at your place of work and somebody shows up and wants to hang out? Like, sorry, I'm working right now. And he, that was his place of work.
Oh, yeah.
Happened to be home.
One aspect of his work ethic, too, is he, you know, a lot of these creators in the Golden Age, it was the Great Depression when, you know, superheroes exploded. And you tend to think of them, a lot of them, of coming from poverty. You know, not necessarily, you know, extreme poverty, but a lot of them were children of immigrants, some immigrants themselves, and they certainly weren't living the high life. But Gardner Fox, he came from a somewhat privileged background. I mean, he wasn't, his family wasn't the Rockefellers or anything, but he was still coming from a pretty, you know, upper middle class or even higher background. Yeah. So it made it even more impressive to me that despite that, he would still, instead of growing up to be somewhat spoiled or lazy like some might be, that he was still, you know, such a strong worker and had that ethic.
I think a lot of that came from his father. Leon Fox seemed to be quite the man. I was really impressed reading, you know, he didn't even get a high school diploma, but he went to Purdue, which is this huge university, and he studied telephones, like, which was still kind of an innovative technology at the time. It was funny, I was watching the Deadwood movie, and I was like, this is the life that Leon Fox was living. Like, I thought that was really fascinating. He was responsible for a lot of the modernization of the island of New York, Long Island. Like, that's huge. And so when you grow up and you see a parental figure putting in that much work, I think that it made it pretty clear what he had to do.
I also thought he seemed kind of a cool dad in the sense that while he was, I wouldn't say he wasn't strict, but the way he, you know, basically made sure his whole family, his children had a library and so early, you know, exposed them to reading. And it was mentioned in the book how much Gardner devoured books at a young age and really through the rest of his life, which is amazing that he would still have time to read given how much time he spent actually writing every single day. But I know Edgar Rice Burroughs was one author you mentioned him loving as a kid and going through his, but that was just one of many. It seems like he was reading constantly from his youth.
Yeah, everything too. He was also big into the classics, and I mean, that's what he went to school for. Even was history and English. And his sister went on to be a librarian too. Like reading, and again with that, that's a gift that Leon gave to the family, I would say.
One other thing that I found was interesting is, you talked about his friendship with Vince Sullivan, who, you know, the writer, editor, artist that worked at DC. And it's funny because you told some stories of the manga, which I won't say here, but it's just always interesting to me. And it kind of came up, even though I'm not to that timeline yet, you already talked a little bit about him and Julia Schwartz kind of friendship, too. And to these to us, these people are idols, and we tend to put them on pedestals. But it's fun to read stories of them just hanging out with their wives and just being buddies and being the godfather to their child. Or I hope you don't. There's one detail I do have to give, which just blew my mind. The fencing. I won't say with who, but when you talked about him and the one comic writer editor in their fencing while they were working out comic
multiple,
plots.
Actually.
Really? Oh, see, I've only gotten to one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing to me, imagining these guys just sitting there fencing and talking about comic book plots and stuff. I love stories like that.
Yeah, talk about a dream. I wish there was some kind of photographic evidence of that. But, I mean, God, like, that's the coolest evening ever, fencing and talking about comic books. Heck yeah.
One thing I did regret, and obviously age-wise, when he passed away, I was still a teenager just starting to go to comic conventions. But his friendship with Burt Chrisman, who co-created this Wesley Dodd Sandman character, who tragically was killed during World War II. And we've both talked about this on Twitter probably, and other people listening probably already know, but he was part of the squadron that became known as the Flying Tigers, and he was killed in World War II. But he was another one that Gardner actually became friends with.
Yeah, and I was shocked. I didn't know the extent of that relationship until I started working on this book.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I knew they both co-created the character, but I had no idea. And I had no idea of his friendship with Sullivan until I read your book or some of the other people you mentioned as well. So that's been a revelation. But Chrisman in particular appealed to me just because I love that character, and him being lost at such a young age has always been such a tragedy. And I would love to have just, if I was a little older and into comics, have had the opportunity to ask Gardner Fox about Chrisman and some of his memories, and not professional memories, but just social memories, just what the guy was like, stuff like that. And that's another thing I should mention as far as kind of obscure information. I am shocked at how much information you were able to dig up, given how long it's been since he passed. And I realize Jerry Bales, Roy Thomas, guys like that have, you know, worked with him to get a lot of this information cataloged from the late 50s, early 60s. So it's not that stuff's not out there, but given that there's never been a sort of comprehensive biography of Fox before, I am stunned by the amount of information you've been able to compile, not just about, you know, his comic writing, but from his youth and his family. It's amazing how much is in this book.
Thank you. I mean, it took me 4 years to do it. but no, the family has been incredibly supportive and helpful. And I mean, my number one thank yous go to Roy Thomas. He has been, I don't know if this would have been possible without him, honestly.
You know, I should put, you posted something in regard to Roy Thomas. Can you tell, if anyone isn't on Facebook following you already or Twitter, can you kind of, I know you may be embarrassed, but hey, enjoy it. You earned it. Tell us about it.
About what he said, or
yes,
about,
what did he say?
He said it 1,000 times better than I could ever. But he makes the argument that my book, in surveying Fox, it is essentially the story of the comic industry itself. And I mean, I honestly, and he wouldn't say it maybe, but it's also the story of comic fandom. And in some ways it's the story of Roy Thomas. Like he gets quite a bit of attention in the later chapters because of how much work he put into trying to get Gardner Fox's name out there when he was older in retirement. Roy Thomas has been a huge advocate for Gardner Fox, and he has done everything he could to try to make this book a possibility.
Well, it's hard to imagine a greater endorsement for longtime comic fans than having, say, people hearing how Roy Thomas has talked about how important and well done this book is. So if you needed an endorsement, there you got it.
It is one heck of an endorsement, I have to say. I never could have dreamed, like, going from my first email to him where I nervously, like, wrote Bikram at the end instead of, like, all best or whatever, like, to him, like, casually we email sometimes. Like,
my mind gets blown when I have a Twitter conversation with the creator. But if I was personally emailing Roy Thomas, I think my head would explode. That would just be too. If I was on a first name basis with him, where he would email me about, like, Mike, here are my thoughts on X, I would die happy at that point. That's just like, you know, I wouldn't even, I don't know if I'd even be able to form sentences articulately if I was conversing with Roy Thomas.
There are times when I have to be like, okay. Like, I'm going to come back to this in an hour after I've calmed down.
But clearly, I mean, he appreciates what you did, and it means a lot to him. And like you said, he's always had an attachment to him. And I haven't gotten to the chapters where he comes into the book more, but am I remembering correct that his favorite hero was Hawkman growing up?
He was a big Hawkman fan, yes. Okay. I would say probably Justice Society of America was his favorite.
Well, yeah, you're right. That was... I should have, but I know he was partial to Joe Kubert as an artist too, who was working on Hawkman, and made him a big part of All-Star Squadron for a while related to that. But yeah, just, and he did, am I also remembering correctly that he did write every single Golden Age JSA tale?
Yes. All the way through, what was it, 34? I'm not 100% on that. I'm terrible with numbers. Absolutely terrible with numbers. I don't have that stat in front of me right now. But yes, he did. He was responsible for almost all of them.
Well, I will always love the archives editions because getting the complete set of the reprints of the All-Stars was the high points of that. There's a few series. Adam Strange, I love having all of them on an archive. Having that one beautiful edition of all the Dr. Fate comics into one book.
God, which, it's so gorgeous, too.
I wish they'd done that with more characters. That was just... that was such a good idea to do a larger edition like that. But also, probably the top of the heap, the creme de la creme of all of them for me, is the All-Star Comics, to have all of those collected in. And I know Roy Thomas wrote the foreword to quite a few of those editions. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure Jerry Bales may have as well at some point, but I'd have to go back and look it up. Yeah, I know both Roy Thomas and Jerry Bales basically are in a lot of ways attributed to founding comics fandom. So I can see why you would say that this book is not just about comics history, but it's about fandom history as well.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole chapter about that. So,
well, I look forward to getting to it. I think you had tweeted as well last year that one of the bound editions that Fox had given one of them was up for sale. Was that you who had tweeted that?
Was me. Yeah, that was another one of the more casual, like, hey, Brett Thomas.
Was that Roy's copy or was that Bale's copy? I don't remember.
Well, it was Bale's. But I mean, genuinely, I would say that stack of comics was the source of comics fandom more than anything else, because Bale's wanted the copies. And this was, you know, back when comics weren't collected, like it was still part of the throwaway culture. And so he reached out to Gardner Fox because he believed that Gardner Fox had the only complete collection, and talked Gardner Fox out of his copies. And then Roy Thomas came along just a little after that and was like, hey, I want those comics. And Gardner Fox was like, well, I'm sorry. Here, I'll send you to Jerry Bales. I just sold them to him. And so they formed a relationship from that where they, like, yeah, it was the whole thing.
So, because I haven't gotten there yet, is that how Roy and Jerry met? Gardner referred to Jerry? Oh, God. That's amazing that that's how the two of them. And I knew that both of them had become kind of letter hacks going out and trying to find some of these people. But I didn't know or didn't remember that Gardner had actually referred them to each other. That's amazing. So what was Gardner's, and if I ask anything that you don't want kind of spoil the book, please stop me and just let me know. But what was Gardner's reaction when these guys started writing him letters?
Well, he liked Jerry Bales and Roy Thomas a lot, I think, because they were educated. The questions that they asked, like he could tell that, like, that it's something specifically Jerry Bales was very good at pointing out how intelligent the scripts were. And that was something that Gardner Fox responded to. And they were both, I mean, I think Roy Thomas was going to school at the time and Bales was a teacher at the time, I believe. They responded well because of that. And Gardner Fox was very happy about Alter Ego coming out and all of that. He really embraced that more scholarly approach to comics.
This is kind of a little off topic, but it's kind of to analogize it a little. As I just finished the book that Bill Shelley wrote on John Stanley, the Little Lulu author, and he was very resistant to comic fandom for a long time. Because he left comics not terribly satisfied with things. But one of the few people, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but one of the few people he kind of opened up with who got him to go to convention, one of the things that appealed to him was that the man was very intelligent, he had a good career, but it was kind of, he came at it from a scholarly approach. He took the comics they meant a lot to him as a child, but he analyzed them and discussed them in a way that Stanley got the sense he treated them as really, you know, important works. And it kind of appealed to, is that kind of a similar reaction Fox had to some of them, that he may have been impressed by the fact that they, you know, were these two intelligent, thoughtful gentlemen who really appreciated what he was trying to do and took his work seriously?
Absolutely. And just like the specific kinds of questions that they asked, I think spoke a lot to him as well. You know, like they both came in with so much knowledge of Fox's canon and comics history in general. Like they were both, they grew up with comics too, and they never lost that love, you know?
Now, one thing I had no idea about Fox, and I didn't learn about really, it involves other creators, I didn't learn about it until you had discussed it on Twitter a year or so ago, and I'm looking forward to getting to the book. And again, share to what extent you're comfortable. Again, we want people to buy the book, so I don't want to spoil. But the circumstances under which he left DC, that was something I had no idea about. Is there anything you kind of want to maybe hint or tantalize people they may find interested without spoiling anything? Like,
well,
or should we save it for them to read?
I think a good tease might be that there's been an increasing talk of unionizing comic books, and that has been a conversation much longer than people might expect.
So back, and again, I haven't gone to it, after he left, and it was 70s and 80s, what kind of stuff was he doing? Just generally, what kind of work was he producing, comic-wise, non-comic-wise, writing books?
Okay. Well, he mostly just moved on to novels. That's when he started doing a lot of fantasy novels. The Kothar and Krillic and all of those started coming out along with other things. That was kind of his main focus. Is he moved on from comics, and then his goal was like a novel a year. That was his retirement. Was he still going to write a novel a year, which is insane to me, having written one and took me 4 years. But
he was a machine. It really is amazing how he could pump these out. But he had been writing books the entire time he was writing comics, correct?
Correct. Well, okay. Not the entire time. The first one, Forge of Blade, came out in, what was that, 64? Like, going to my own timeline. I really should just keep that up. I really need to get better about my numbers. Borgia Blade at 53.
Okay, so he didn't start until 53. Okay.
Yeah. He had written short stories before that point, but that was the first time he decided to take that to a novel.
So have you read many of those books as part of this process? Did you go through and read a lot of his novels?
I've read a lot of everything. Some of them I just skimmed because, I mean, I can't possibly read everything.
Oh, God.
But
it would certainly take longer than 4 years to get through it all.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. But I've read a fair amount. Yeah.
Is there any particular one you'd recommend or any ones you thought were especially interesting?
Honestly, I loved Escape the Cosmos. I thought it was really fun. It's quintessential Fox too. Like, and there were some interesting concepts that he got close to exploring. Like, there was almost an environmentalist tilt to it that I thought was interesting. There was some Lovecraftian stuff and multidimensional type stuff. I thought it was really fun. And that was something I wish I had talked about more in the novel. It was actually plagiarized twice, but seemingly by the same person, and like just a new cover and a new title and like some subtle changes. The reason I couldn't include it was because I couldn't find any good actual sources to cite that information. I could find a little bit about it online, but even then the sources that they were citing, they couldn't give that information, so I couldn't. I'm like, it's not validated, but fascinating nevertheless.
Now, you mentioned there were some Lovecraftian elements to that book and it being your favorite, and that was also something that came up in the Dr. Fate discussion. Is that an area? Is that something you're particularly interested in generally, regardless of Gardner Fox?
I do like Lovecraft. I like horror, and I like cosmic horror, and I like that sort of earthly, ancient, kind of we can't understand it sort of horror. There's something that I think is really appealing about that, because we act like we know so much about our world, but we really know so little. And it's good to remind ourselves of that sometimes.
You know, bringing up Lovecraft might be a good segue into this topic, because I know some elements of Lovecraft's work and opinions are a little dated as far as race and aspect. We don't want to get into that, but, you know, Gardner Fox, his work in the 40s in comics and JSA, it's like anything, you know, sometimes the way race and gender was handled, it's difficult to read now. I think you used the term wince at one point in the book, which I mentioned Golden Age comics.
That was
obviously,
Roy Thomas,
so.
Actually.
Oh, it was? Yeah. And so I've had plenty of moments doing that myself reading this. But despite that, I got the sense from how you describe Fox that he, you know, it's there because he's a man of his times. But he seemed pretty progressive overall, and you touched on that a little with Hawkgirl, I think, in that relationship. Was that your sense of Gardner Fox?
Absolutely, especially when it comes to race, which I don't think is immediately obvious sometimes because of the othering that was so common. But he really did see everybody as being essentially the same, regardless of where the person is from or what their life is. He seemed to just see that, you know, humans are humans. We're all struggling, and people should be respected for being people, regardless of gender or race or anything else.
Did you see any common themes in how he handled gender in the women in the comics he wrote?
I have a whole chapter on that. And some of that, I admit, is, you know, what I study. But yeah, he really saw women as being capable and strong. And I think a big part of that was the women around him. His sister was this juggernaut in her town. Like, the sheer number of projects that, like, she, like, the library has a wing named after her, even. And his wife really seemed to be, like, it seems very matriarchal in his family structure. His mother, too, seemed like she was a fairly strong woman for the time. And so I think it would be really weird for him to write women that faint away when that wasn't his life experience. Even, you know, something like Joan Williams graduating alongside Jay Garrick in the original Flash. He went to school, and when he graduated, three women were part of his graduating class. So his life experience, I don't think, matched up quite as much with the biases that we assume from that era.
And I was asking you about your comic reading background. So I wanted to kind of end getting back to you and your family. You know, I have kids, and you have kids too, correct?
Yes, I've got two boys.
Okay. How old are they?
He's 16 and 12.
I was just curious, are they into comics?
Super into comics. Always have been. Like, they're the kinds of kids that, while other kids were, you know, memorizing the planets and dinosaurs, my kids were memorizing character stats and getting into debates about who would win in various different challenges. And they've always loved comics. Although my oldest has gotten a lot more selective as he's gone along. Standard superhero fare has kind of lost interest in his book. But
so
he still likes Paper Girls and things like that. He still reads, but
I very much like Paper Girls too. So shares, but I still like the quite a few superhero stories too. So his taste might be a little more mature than mine are. But, hey, where's the younger one now? What kind of stuff is the younger one reading?
He just finished drama. He liked that a lot. One of his favorite is probably C.C. Bell. El Defo, he thought, was just amazing. And he rereads that one here and there, which is adorable.
You have a really cool household.
Thank you. I'm pretty proud of it.
Well, you know, one thing I forgot to ask you that I need to get out there is, where can people find your book?
Right now, it is on Amazon, and it should be on most Amazons at this point. There will be digital versions coming out soon. You can also get it on Injure. And then if you are a comic shop, please direct message me, because I've got some things worked out that we can try to get it into some comic shops.
Okay. When you say direct message you, where can people find you to do that?
On Twitter at Jennifer Durant.
Yes. And I will say, for my own opinion, I have very much been enjoying the book, and I know I've seen a lot of excitement on Twitter among other comic fans who picked it up recently and are reading it, so we're all getting a lot of enjoyment out of it. So I would, for whatever it's worth, I would definitely recommend it as well.
Thanks. So,
yeah, and I do want to thank you again for coming on and talking to me about it. I really appreciate it, and for writing the book, too. I think it's, like you said at the beginning, it is a hugely important part of comic book history. Not did Gardner Fox as a man, as a writer, all the, you know, we've already talked too much probably about how prolific he is, but, and we've only touched on some of his most well-known comic creations, but it goes far beyond what we've talked about. But hell, just saying the words Justice Society of America and Justice League of America alone, even if he hadn't created a ton of the actual members of those teams as well, that alone, it's difficult to describe how, what a contribution that's been to American comics.
I mean,
you've done a great
the Avengers without it.
This is true. We wouldn't have the event. We wouldn't have any teams. He was the first. No. It was the first team. God, that's amazing. It's one of those ideas that in retrospect is so incredibly obvious, but only after someone's done it. There always has to be that first one to do it.
Yep.
And I always love that cover to All-Star Comics 3 where they're around the table.
I know.
it's one of there's just something about the in that and the use of the name Society. And they'll go on to fight supervillains together, but having them take the name Society and seeing them first sitting around a table like that.
Yeah.
And even the first story or two was them sort of telling adventures as opposed to having them together.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the clear distinctions between, say, Avengers and the Marvel teams in general is Fox's teams seem to be based more on friendship than anything else. And I really, really like that.
That's true. It's probably why FF and JSA are two of my favorite teams. It's because they're more about friendship and family than the other ones. Whereas, and I love the Avengers, but they're those people that become friends after fighting each other and fighting together and can still have their disagreements. Not that family doesn't have disagreements, but from the beginning, you know, like the FF is family. The JSA, you get a sense that they come together out of a mutual respect for each other. Yeah. And no matter what drama has happened over the years, that's still, even in the series that started in 99, which is one of my favorite series, that sense of family and camaraderie was very strong. But yeah, you did a big service for comics in writing the book. So thank you.
Thank you. This means a lot. And I thank you so much for helping to, you know, spread the word of Gardner Fox. Like, I really enjoy our interactions on Twitter and elsewhere.
No, thank you. I've learned quite a bit following you, and I'd recommend anyone else do it if they can, if they're on Twitter. With that, I think I'm going to wrap things up. But this has been a lot of fun. And one final thank you to her for coming on, and to you all for listening. I appreciate it. I know Chris and I have been in hiatus for much of this year, but it's been fun to come back and talk to Jennifer. I didn't want to miss this opportunity. It's been great. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up. Take care.
The Justice League of America, the combined might and power of the Man of Steel and the Cosmic Crusader, the Winged Avenger and the King of the Sea, the Tiny Titan and the Scarlet Streak. All working together for good against evil as the Justice League of America.